I have to say, listening to that introduction, which was so beautiful by Judith, it makes me feel really old. But many of you knew me when I was very young. And we don't need to go there, no. And some of you even remember when I was a school teacher for Santa Barbara Schools. And I think for many of us, we'll talk about pilgrimage and life as a pilgrimage, but we do have different incarnations, don't we? Mm-hmm. Our life takes different turns, and it's wonderful to look out here and see so many of you who have shared some of those with me. And here we are in this moment together, which is a great celebration. I want to tell you, if you're going on a pilgrimage or a trip, Judith is the roommate you want. She doesn't snore. She's neat and tidy. She has a great sense of humor. And if you say, do you want to do this? She'll go, I'm in. And I really have to say, all of us in the group really enjoyed Dana and her husband were wonderful companions. As just walking in the door, Anna and John, we really formed an incredible connection on this trip, and we'll say a little bit more about that. But I have to say, Judith and I are bonded. This particular trip, and I just want to say one thing about, was a return for me. But as we made our journey to Iona, which is quite an arduous journey in modern times, compared to what the Celtic pilgrims experienced island to island and land to land, this is nothing. But it takes a lot of getting there. You fly to Glasgow or Edinburgh, you take a train, you take a ferry, you take a bus, you take another ferry, and you walk. So it is truly a physical embodiment of what pilgrimage is. And when Judith had spoken to me and mentioned this class and Philip's book, I was very enthusiastic. Although I had never met him, when you go to Iona, his literature and his presence as part of the community is very well felt in liturgy and the whole ethos of the place. So here we are boarding the ferry, the first big ferry, and I see Philip. And I've only seen pictures of him, but I knew. So I jokingly said, I think, to Dana, oh my gosh, we've got to calm Judith down when she sees him. It's going to be electric. So I quietly went over and I said, he's here. She said, who? Here. And we just kind of gazed at him from afar on the ferry, but had a number of opportunities, which I think Judith will talk about through the week, to be with him, to speak with him. He's a very gifted teacher, and as we like to say, he's the real deal. The real deal. He remembers people, he's truly interested in what you have to say. And I think you get that tenor from his writing, don't you? I mean, he engages deeply. And in the chapter we'll consider today, we really feel that. Well, my first trip to Iona, and I'll just say a word about that, happened about 9 years ago. I had heard about Iona over and over again from my Presbyterian friends. Now, I know, I said to Sally Spence this morning, many of you, for you, Ireland is a spiritual home. For me, Scotland has become a spiritual home. I grew up Presbyterian. So even though I'm ordained in the UCC, I heard stories about Iona. And when my husband and I were graced with a 3 or 4 month sabbatical, I said, you know, it would start my sabbatical really richly to be able to go and be with the community on Iona for a week. So I did. That was my first week in Scotland. It was an incredible experience. As I said, the journey itself getting there is a little overwhelming. And you come to this very remote, isolated place, which feels like it's at the end of the world almost, to be surrounded by beauty and liturgy and work and prayer. And my first week there, of the two facilities, I stayed at the one that, instead of two in a room, has five in a room. And one of the things the community really wants to help people understand in Celtic spirituality is the relationship between work, prayer, and community. And I got a deep plunge into all three. That time I had roommates that snored. I think one was 92 and the other was 16, and we ran the gamut from there. We had tasks every day, whether it's cleaning the bathroom, washing dishes, chopping carrots. Everyone is engaged with work. But at 9 o'clock in the morning, it all stops, and we go to worship together. And what was unique for me is that worship didn't end in a blessing or a benediction. It ended at 9:15 or 9:20 with going to work. And that our work of prayer was continued in our physical labors in caring for the facility and for one another. And I never lived that before. I'd done a lot of retreats. Don George will tell you, when I first started off, I took a suitcase of clothes and a suitcase of books. And that was my idea of a retreat. I've come a long way, but I never integrated this whole understanding. It was so transformative for me that I made arrangements to go my last week of the sabbatical. And since that time, I've been privileged to go back at least once a year since that time. And as I say, it's my spiritual home. It's the place that I have been able to connect most deeply with my understanding of God. And perhaps at the root of that is some of what we'll talk about today in the Celtic perspective on the world. You've heard this before. It's considered to be a thin place. And although that understanding kind of, it's hard to give language to, it's an experience. And I have a sense that if we were to go around the room, everyone here has had some experience of a thin place, where that distance between heaven and earth seems very sheer. It's very close to us. Maybe at the birth of a baby, maybe at the death of a friend. But that quality of thinness seems to permeate the island of Iona. This isn't a new phenomenon. This experience has been well tested over time because people have journeyed there since the 500s because of that quality. And we'll say more about that in a minute. So it was because of that experience that I had an opportunity last year to go and live as a volunteer with the community on Iona for 2 months. And you do something called a volley, and our group met some of those volleys. You volunteer and help maintain the facility and greet people who come from around the world to breathe in this place and space. I'll say more about Columba, but know that the dates we're going to be talking about today, in terms of this flavor of Celtic spirituality and passion for pilgrimage, really are in the 500s and 600s. And if you consider Patrick, which I know all you Irish people will, he isn't as high on our list in Scotland, but we consider him an important part of the group. Well, I read this quote, and this passion that grew in me for pilgrimage is not new. It is well founded in the Celtic passion for pilgrimage. And this academic wrote, two passions were strong in the Irish. One was for learning to be found in Christian books. They could see, touch, and even in some cases read the books. To them, the thrilling embodiment of the world beyond their shores. The other Celtic passion was, and I quote, pilgrimage for the love of God. By this, they meant the heroic self-discipline of one who has exiled themselves from the land of their birth and the land of their heart. Now, with that in mind, we come to this chapter today. What a challenging chapter. Chapter 6 in Philip's book, Paying the Piper, where he poetically and artistically and beautifully brings forth the themes of sin, forgiveness, and the real one to wrestle with, substitutionary atonement. He does this from a deep perspective of Celtic spirituality. And by that I mean he's well-versed in the oral tradition of the people, in the story-formed community. In other words, it's not a doctrinal community. It's a story-formed, lived experience community. And from personal experience. Those three things are very important in the way he addresses these issues. And in the short time we have, I want to come to those, but not head on. I said to somebody earlier, I'm not going to go head into that one. It's kind of scary. But I come to these issues as what I would call a hands-on theologian, a practical theologian. And for me, the way I consider these issues is dependent on my lived experience as well as what we know and teach, and I think Newell does that very well in this chapter. So what I want to lift up here is really, for me, what's at the heart of this chapter, and that's his questions. Philip's good at asking and posing questions and putting those questions up against his lived experience. And his lived experience says that his and the Celtic experience of God and Christ are different than the doctrinal experience. We all kind of can agree on that. So I want to pose or pull out from that text three questions that I think are critical and at the heart of what I consider pilgrimage. The first one is, who are the people who have truly loved us in our lives? He asked that question in the chapter. Who are the people who have truly loved us? That's an experiential question. That's a story-formed question, not a doctrinal question. Who are those people? And if we were on a retreat day together, we could spend some time with that and explore that deeply. And I challenge you, as you reflect on this chapter in this book, to really come to his questions. He doesn't answer them always, but he puts them at the heart of our experience. So, second, who are we prepared to give our hearts to? That's a critical question for me. Who am I, having some experience of being truly loved, who am I willing to give my heart to? And the third one, and he's got a lot more, but I want to focus on these three. How can you look into another's heart in ways that will open up the hidden wellsprings of life and new beginnings? Now that, to me, kind of summarizes or brings together those two other questions. I'll read it again. How can we look into another's heart in ways that will open up the hidden wellsprings of life and new beginnings? And I think he rounds out those questions by pointing to the cross, which we'll take up in a moment, and God's forgiveness framed by our experience of love. So the cross becomes a pointer to our lived experience of God's forgiveness in love. So for me, where I am in this point in my journey, these questions, what I call love questions, are really journey questions. They're pilgrimage questions. They're questions we take with us on the road. They're good questions for a pilgrim. So what is pilgrimage? And you have a sheet on your seat in which I've lifted up just a couple of definitions or ways of thinking about them. One is by an author I really come to love. He writes out of the Celtic Scottish tradition. His name is Ian Bradley. He's a professor at St. Mary's College at the University of St. Andrews and has led a lot of pilgrimages. He's done a lot of work for the BBC in the UK on the whole notion of pilgrimage. And in addition to all that, and being an incredible writer, he He is an ordained minister in the Church of Scotland, the Presbyterian Church. And I have his book up here, and I've listed several others that you might want to take a look at the break. Ian Bradley's thought is that pilgrimage is best defined as a departure from daily life on a journey in search of spiritual well-being. It involves leaving home, making a journey, arriving at a destination that usually has some religious significance, and then returning home. One of the issues that comes up in the notion of pilgrimage, and in a way, the Celtic experience kind of throws this off as well, is that many times, Columba, Aidan, many of them went out as pilgrims for Christ and did not come home. Now, we had a very insightful conversation. If you ever want to have a good speaker, you get Randy and Dana Vandermeer to talk, because Randy, who's a professor at Westmont, brought up this notion of, do you have to have a destination for it to be a pilgrimage? Now, traditionally, you did. But I would contend, and I'm exploring in contemporary times, that the destination may be there, but we may reach it anywhere along the way. It may be your real home. Exactly. And that's what Columba found. And so, you know, we've got to take these notions and kind of move with them and speak out, which I'm sure you are not uncomfortable doing. Your name is?
Alan.
I'm kidding.
Alan. And I'm Celtic, Gaelic, Welsh, and Scottish.
Good. You're on my team. We'll have little separate corners at the end of this. Thank you. But you can see how challenging these definitions are. We've got to have some language to give us a structure and a form, but then we've got to push the edges as well. I actually met Ian Bradley on my last trip, and he's quite an interesting man. He's written several books on the theology of the musical and the opera. And he's a singer and a performer, and very different energy from a Philip Newell, who kind of has this presence that he carries with him. And Ian Bradley's kind of, okay, let's get going here. So pilgrims come in all shapes and sizes. Another definition, and this comes from a man named Gary Johnson, who I found when I was doing some research on the Camino de Compostela, which we'll say a little bit more about later. A pilgrimage is the most graphic reminder that we can have that our life as a whole is a pilgrimage. Each of us is on a journey with God and to God. That works for me. But I would also contend that there are pilgrimages within pilgrimages. And we had a wonderful experience of this on Iona this year. As part of your week with the community, there's a pilgrimage around the island of Iona. And it models a formal pilgrimage in that you stop at certain places, you hear a story about the place, you sing a psalm, you hear scripture, and then you move on. Well, the day that we were scheduled to go, the winds were blowing from Hurricane Katrina. And we were literally locked in. Not just to the Abbey, but it reminds me of the story Columba said. He prophesied that when he died, there would be no big funeral for him. People couldn't get to the island because there would be a big storm. And sure enough, the day he died, the wind came up, and only the monks were present for his burial. Well, we had the same experience. The milk was running out. And so even in these days and times, the ferry can't run when certain conditions are present. So we had a pilgrimage within the pilgrimage, because instead of going around the island, they took us through the Abbey. And we did the same thing. We started outside at the chapter house. We had a reading. We sang a hymn. We made a connection with the biblical story. And then we moved through the entire Abbey in that same fashion. It was wonderful. And it helped me. I've kind of designed a template now that faith communities could do that in their own church. They could take a pilgrimage in their own congregation or parish or synagogue. So, anyway, this is a much more inclusive definition. And lastly, I love this one. It's so simple. A pilgrimage is a journey placed in God's hands. Wow, that really opens it up, doesn't it? And I got this from Jamie, who is the assistant warden right now for the Iona community. That's the way she talks about pilgrimage. Any journey placed in God's hands. So whether we have a destination or not, coming over here today, if you place this journey and today's journey of life in God's hands, you're on pilgrimage. Well, so with those definitions in mind, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Celtic impulse or passion for pilgrimage. Mindful that the word passion means suffering. Okay? So we're not talking, sometimes we think about, oh, his passion for life. Well, passion, by definition, means suffering. And one of the first definitions is the suffering of Christ on the cross. So to have a passion for pilgrimage, and going back to that earlier statement that the Irish had two passions, Christian literature, books, and pilgrimage, they were open to suffering. So who are these people? And that's one of the first questions I have. Who are the Celtic pilgrims? And why did they go? What motivated them? How did they even find their way? And lastly, what do their lives and their journey and their experiences of love, forgiveness have to say to us today? Well, let me just say a little bit about a few of those pilgrims. And I know many of you have studied them, but I hope some of these stories kind of opens that up a little bit. St. Patrick, you know a lot about him. He was Romano Briton. He was a slave. He was a Christian missionary who started a monastery. He worked with people, and this is really important to me. He worked with people where they were. He met them where they were, and I think that's a critical piece of the Celtic understanding. Christ comes to people where they are. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful Bible translation in Scots. It's a New Testament in Scots, and the whole thing reads, Jesus went down to the loch. He went up to the bairn. It's not set in Jerusalem. It's not sent in what we understand as Palestine and Israel today. It's set in Scotland, which is very exciting. And I think Patrick and these other pilgrims knew how to do that. They took people where they were, and they worked with what they believed in already. Hence, we often say, well, you know, that has pagan roots. Yes, it does. It does. Actually, a lot of things in Christianity do. Uh-oh. We're in trouble now. But
that reminds me of the Cotton Patch Gospel.
The Cotton Patch Gospel, yeah. There's so many wonderful understandings of the biblical text that just aren't set in the old country, wherever that is. So, one of the things Patrick did too, besides take them where they were, meet them with what they believed, he loved them. He loved the people that he worked with. And I think these early Irish, Scottish, Welsh, Celtic pilgrims for Christ loved the people they went to see, which I think, from my reading of history, is very different from the Roman mission. Very different from the Roman mission. So, there's a wonderful story about Patrick, maybe you know it, that one day he was preaching to the heathen, that's the way the story goes, just before he was to baptize them. And he was standing by a Druidic standing stone. And he had these heathens all around. And before he did the baptism, he made the sign of the cross on the standing stone. And that was the first Celtic cross. I love that story. So the story goes. And a lot of hagiography, we know, is embellished. But I think it's to the heart of where his heart was. He didn't lecture at that standing stone. He didn't shake his finger. He blessed what they knew and what they had experienced and took it forward. So he and other Celtic pilgrims sought to incorporate the pagan practices and ideas right in to the Christian understanding. He just helped them make that transfer. St. Columba was another one of those pilgrims, and I know you know a lot about him. So the story goes, he was a soldier, he was a monk, he was a very bright young man, but after copying a book in a scriptorium that he was allowed to copy but not keep, a conflict broke out, and many people were killed, tribal conflict about this particular book. He was so disturbed by that conflict that he self-exiled himself. He said, I'm going to go off and become a pilgrim for Christ. And as was typical of the monks of that day, he gathered in his coracle, which was an open boat, 12 other monks. This was always, when they go out, they model Christ and his disciples. They take 12 with them. He landed at several places, so the story goes. But every time he looked back, he could see Ireland. And his exile required that he be a pilgrim for Christ in a place where he could no longer see Ireland. That passion, that suffering, that self-imposed discipline. So he landed at a place we've come to call Columbus Bay. It's a very rocky shore on the south end of the island. And from there, Ireland could not be seen, never again. And from that humble beginning with 12 monks, there evolved an incredible center of art, music, and I would like to say encounters with angels, which may be part of that sense of the thin place. When you read Ottoman's biography of Columba, angels are always involved. They're everywhere. He sees them, he communicates with them, they're always part of his experience. So the story goes that he continued to travel all over Scotland, walking, very Christ-like, all over Scotland, converting the Picts and other tribal groups, and actually brought unity to that part of the world. Just a couple more. Another one you've read about, Aidan. And the date of his birth is unknown, but he died in 651. So you can see these individuals, these Celtic pilgrims for Christ, are all kind of around a similar time, 500, 600, 700. It's a real strong piece of it. He was sent, this is important, he was sent from Iona to the east coast to start a monastery and convert the tribal people there at the request of Oswald, the king. And he built his monastery on a very holy place, very similar to Iona, called Lindisfarne. Have any of you been there to Lindisfarne? Martha, okay. A true pilgrim in the back there, and she's wearing purple too. Lindisfarne, which is also called the Holy Isle, was where he established his monastic center in the model of Iona. And again, it became an incredible center of teaching and outreach. And it's understood that the Book of Kells, which is now in a museum in Dublin, was written at Lindisfarne. Now, Lindisfarne had another interesting challenge for pilgrims then and today. It's a tidal island, like Mont Saint-Michel. So access to it is only when the tide has receded. And even though there's a causeway out today, it's still difficult to access when the tidal surge comes. And so during ancient pilgrimage times, or old pilgrimage times, there was a pole system established. And even today, pilgrims to Lindisfarne will take their shoes off, walk in the mud flats at the low tide, and go from pole to pole. And in that, I think it's about a 2-mile stretch, are several shelters built up on the pole. So if for some reason you've missed the tide, you can get up there. There are wonderful stories about pilgrims waiting for the tide to shift and encountering angels on the way. So Aidan was very much a part of that. Let's see. That pilgrimage place also became important because of St. Cuthbert. And you've learned about St. Cuthbert, I think, let me say just a little bit about him. And it's not all men. I have a woman here. St. Cuthbert lived from 634 to about 687, in that same period. He was the bishop at Lindisfarne. Later on, he was a hermit, a mystic, a healer. And he was known as a protector of the people. Again, this modeling of Christ, Christ's love and forgiveness. He didn't want to be the bishop, but he answered the call. His relics were there for some time. And later, because of Viking invasions, they were taken to what's now understood to be at the cathedral at Durham. So that's another place of pilgrimage. It's quite a remarkable people. There is now a pilgrim way from Melrose to Lindisfarne. It's about a six-day walking pilgrimage called St. Cuthbert's Way. And that's where, at the end, people take off their shoes, go across the mud flats, and worship and be in the presence of that place. One other person who I think fits in here, and it is hard to find the women. Mostly, I think, and we read the Carmina Gadelica of the Celtic prayers, the women were tending the hearth, they were doing the things at home, they were right there with Jesus at the fireplace, milking the cow, you know, we know that. But I think one that we can put in this Celtic group of pilgrims is Hilda. And, you know, she and Aidan had a relationship, and even now there is the community of Aidan and Hilda on Lindisfarne. And it's very similar in its mission to the Iona community. I spent some time there last year. They have less a life of work community prayer and more community in prayer. So if you don't want to work, that might be the place to go. No, I'm kidding. They're very deep spirituality. And they, in addition to Christ, they follow the teachings and way of Hilda and Aidan. Now, she's also known as Hilda of Whitby. You know, I'm sure, the Synod of Whitby in 644 is where these conflicts that had been brewing between the Celtic way and the Roman way really came to a head. And a lot of them were kind of interesting things, like how you cut your hair, right? The tonsure. What date you celebrate Easter. And also the hierarchy of the church and who you report to. And that event at Whitby in Hilda's Abbey, I hadn't realized that they had convened in her abbey. She had a double abbey with men and women. They worshiped together but lived separately, and that's the place they chose to have this big event. They went away with it, with most of the Lindisfarne and Iona community monks not agreeing with that. And eventually a lot of those monks went back to Ireland. So, these are our pilgrims. I posed that question, who are they? Another question, why did they go? They went because they felt exiled. They went to have reconciliation and forgiveness. Many pilgrimages in the Middle Ages, as we move through this time, were court-ordered. You got a choice. Wouldn't that be great today? You do something wrong, you get a choice. You can go on a pilgrimage, walk the mission trail, San Diego to Sonoma, or you can go to jail. So, something to think about. I think, you know, it sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? I wouldn't want to lead that group. They found their way, and I know our time is flying here, but they found their way with waymarkers. And what were those waymarkers? This is important to this whole notion of love and forgiveness. A waymarker, a cairn. And I don't know, you all can't see it here, but it's a pile of stone. The oldest directional symbol. But you know, those Celtic people, they didn't leave it at a pile of three. Some of their cairns, the one on Iona and Donegal is probably 6 to 7 feet high, and the one on Camino is a mountain. So a pile of stones is an important waymarker. I have another one over there I just love. I found it at La Casa de Maria in the bookshop. And you can actually take it apart and put it together in different ways. So cairns were a way they found their way. But the other, and most importantly, and this gets kind of back to the chapter, is Celtic crosses. Now, originally there were two kinds of Celtic crosses. There were the slabs, and there were the standing crosses. Slabs were etched in, carved in, and usually were down. The standing crosses, which we see all over Scotland, in Ireland, were carved out. You know, it's kind of like Michelangelo having the shape take place out of the stone. Originally, many of them were wooden, and they were covered with metal. But as they perfected their carving techniques, they took those druidic stones that graced the landscape and turned them into Celtic crosses. Philip indicates in our chapter today that these crosses, that crosses themselves, are a belief pointed to, not defined. I really love that, and that speaks to crosses as a way marker. It's a belief pointed to, not defined. And for the most part, as opposed to the continent, the Celtic crosses are empty crosses, aren't they? Christ isn't crucified there. It's the Christ who's with us. It's the Cairo. It's the circle of eternity in the midst of the cross. I'm getting away from myself here. I know I wanted to read you from his book. When he first talks about crosses in the beginning of that chapter, he said, "But often our response to crosses represents not the acceptance, like wearing one, of religious orthodoxy, but an intuition that the cross somehow relates to love." The cross relates to love. So, these stylized crosses, and if we have the time, I did some breakdown on the four major Iona crosses and what they represent. But let me just say that the circle of eternity, marking the pilgrim's path, establishing physical boundaries between places, that's another way they pointed the way. A place to mark a preaching spot at a crossroads. So often there will be a Celtic cross at a crossroads where villagers would gather from, outlying areas to hear preaching of an itinerant monk. Now, do we need to stop for the break? Or?
Well, do you want to do the video before the break or after the break?
Before.
Should we do it before? Okay. Wait, get it warmed up. This always happens to me. There's just so much to share and so much to talk about.
We can continue after the break.
Okay. Let me just say this, and then we'll have this video. What I had hoped to do is have this be the very end, but we still have more to cover. But I hope it sets the tone for you of what I think this chapter is about. This Celtic passion for pilgrimage has a lot to do with forgiveness, sin, and the understanding that we are all Christ. We are all part of the Christ. So when Columba went, when Aidan went, they went as pilgrims for Christ. They were Christ bearers. And as you know from this chapter, it's a completely different understanding than the dogmatic hierarchical perspective. So what I've tried to do here is invite your heart to pilgrimage. And I'm sharing with you in this several places of pilgrimage that have been important to me. You'll see some standing crosses. You'll see Lindisfarne. Another sacred place is St. Andrews in Scotland, which is a very old place of pilgrimage. All with this same ethos that the Celtic passion is about forgiveness, modeling the Christ, accepting people for who they are, where they are. And we'll come back to those three questions that we started with that Philip brought up in the beginning. So
that tripped when the thing got
that there was a power cord in that cave. So right now, it's the red lights are on, saying that maybe we'd better try to wait until after the break.
Good. That's okay. No, due to technical difficulties, we'll work it out.
We hope.
Take the break.
Yeah.